Welcome to Oncology Today, optimizing the use of androgen deprivation therapy for patients with prostate cancer. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Raina McKay from the University of California in San Diego, California. To begin, I asked Dr. McKay to discuss the new terminology being used to classify different stages of prostate cancer.
When we first came up with the term CRPC with prostate cancer working group 3, there was a lot of, oh my God, it doesn't roll off your tongue. Like, what are we doing? I think we're going to get there. So it's APMS, APMR. APMS
is
androgen pathway modulating sensitive, androgen pathway modulating resistant. And so I think the confusion stems in where you kind of draw the line with this, right? Like HSPC and CRPC have almost become regulatory constructs, you know, and
right.
We think of them as distinct states from a regulatory standpoint of the first treatment versus the second treatment. Or what do you do? And so I think there's a little bit of blurriness, and I think the APMR... there's a lot of drugs that are androgen pathway modulating beyond the 4 drugs that we know to be the modulators, like, right? Like there's AR degraders, there's other. So I think there's going to be an evolution. I think as studies begin to adopt working group 4 criteria in their registrational trials, as I think our industry partners and, you know, phase 2, phase 3 studies start to adopt, I think that people will become more acclimated with the terminology. But I think patients
particularly
love it.
Oh, really? Yeah, well, they definitely, I'm sure, don't like the word castrate. But, I think part of the issue, too, is going to be you have this other one, APM, like you said, R, or sensitive or resistant. And, like, how do you define? It's breast cancer, same thing. How do you define hormone resistance? Like, how long ago do they have to get it and all that? But, anyhow, I applaud you because it's definitely more accurate. All right, let's get into some of the things that you talked about. And, you know, one of the things in your talk that really struck me was you were talking about the issue with relugolix that, of course, everybody, you know, lit onto immediately once we first started to see the data was the issue about cardiovascular disease. And I am interested about where you think that is nowadays, because I know initially there's a lot of excitement. Then I heard people were maybe not so sure about it. But actually, the really thing I wanted to ask you about was the slide that you got into in terms of the mechanism. But before we get into that, at this point, do you think that relugolix or the antagonist have a cardiovascular advantage?
You know, I think some of the data definitely points in that direction. I will say that the best thing you can do for somebody to optimize their cardiovascular risk is be proactive about primary prevention and be engaged with their primary physician and their cardiologist. There was a study that basically compared degarelix to lupron, and it was designed to actually assess cardiovascular toxicity. But the study was designed in a manner where everybody had to undergo a cardiovascular assessment, and they all underwent lipid profile and all that. Like, there was a lot of, like, intensity even beyond what, like, I think we probably integrate into clinical practice, and there was no difference. And so to me, the message is, like, be on top of it, be, prevention is key. But that being said, you know, what's the downside of using an antagonist if somebody does have a risk? Like, I have patients that they've had a couple of heart attacks, they've got some AFib, they're on a blood thinner. I'm like, why am I fighting it? Like, there's nothing to, like, absolutely. Like, even if there's a hint that it's going to be better, I'm going to give it to my patient, you know? It's not going to be worse. There's no data to suggest that it's worse, you know?
Well, we can get into that, too, because I am interested in how this actually plays out clinically. But, I mean, also, you know, there are a lot of lipid-lowering drugs where I'm sure there is cardiovascular data, but you know that that type of profile is associated with, you know, something in less cholesterol, whatever, that's going to have a positive effect. So I guess you could look at it this way. But the thing I really lit on, and I'm always realizing things that I don't understand, I thought it was kind of straightforward. I'm going to ask you a very basic question because you have this really cool graphic. That's what caught my attention, which is potential mechanisms driving CV advantage. But what struck me but there's a difference between agonists and antagonists. So what I'd like you to do, and then we can get into all these intermediate things in your graphic, but just to begin, just to go back and talk about the exact MOA of an antagonist versus an agonist, like what happens to the endocrine profile. And then also, maybe you could throw in a little bit about what happens, first of all, not only when you take estrogen, which you mentioned in your talk, you didn't talk about testosterone. That's a treatment, right?
Well, BAT, bipolar androgen therapy. Okay, so let me try to break it down. With regards to the agonists, the way that normally GnRH or the gonadotropins, I think, are released, is they're released in a pulsatile fashion throughout the day. And so there's pulsatile stimulation of the pituitary gland, the hypothalamic pituitary axis, resulting in a little bit of like LH and FSH that then acts on the testicle to make testosterone. So that's like normally what happens in like normal physiology. But when you have an agonist on board, instead of this pulsatile activity, you are constantly like have your foot on the gas, like turning on the axis. And by doing that, the axis kind of runs out of batteries. You've like stepped on the gas and now you're out of fuel and there's not this, there's a negative feedback that takes place and actually the axis shuts down. So that's how the agonists work. They initially continuously turn it on. So there's actually a surge in T before they turn it off. And when they turn it off, there's not as dramatic a decline in, like, the LH and FSH certainly drop, but there's still some residual, like, FSH, okay? So now with an antagonist, it's not this continuous on that results in an off. You actually, in fact, block the receptor. And so there is, like, less release of LH and FSH, and the decline in FSH is even more dramatic with an antagonist, and then that results in less T being made from the testicle.
So now, it's working in the pituitary gland.
Correct. Yes, that's correct. Now, if we think about bipolar androgen therapy, it's used in a different state, right? So in the state of castration resistant, which is now the APMR state, there's changes that happen in the androgen receptor. And one of the mechanisms of resistance to being in a state that's deprived of testosterone is actually making more androgen receptor. It's like if you're going to take away all of the key, you can think of testosterone as the key. Well, I'm just going to like amplify the number of doors. So the likelihood that any little bit of key that's out there is going to, you know, open my lock type of thing, I guess my crazy analogy. But like you basically, one of the mechanisms of resistance is amplifying the androgen receptor. So then if that's sort of what's happening in the tumor, and now you go and expose that tumor to a ton of testosterone, like a ton of testosterone, then the androgen receptor is like so happy and there's like a regression. Like there's like, you know, it had amplified and was stimulating all this prostate cancer to get worse. But then it kind of like regresses because now it's in this milieu of high testosterone. So because there's this regression of the androgen receptor, that impacts the pathogenesis of like downstream, like, impact on the tumor. At least that's the proposed mechanisms.
Makes sense.
Now,
makes sense.
So that's what it is. So estrogens, I think if we think about the way estrogens basically would work, there's in the periphery, testosterone is actually, peripherally converted into estrogen. And so when you give estrogen, that results in a negative feedback to the hypothalamus pituitary telling it to suppress GnRH, LH, and FSH secretion. So you're giving not to say, like, you're giving estrogen, which then negatively feedbacks.
Yeah, makes
so
sense.
You actually
makes
drop
sense.
Tea. So
awesome. Well, that's really helpful to me. But let me just throw in one more thing. I see you have a paper here. You're involved with everything, but with androgen receptor degraders. Like,
yes.
Maybe you can comment on how they work and also whether it looks like they're active. I'm kind of curious. Do you see responses?
Yeah, we certainly see responses. So I think, the concept behind the degraders are, well, if the whole problem with prostate cancer pathogenesis is the androgen receptor, and we have one mechanism where we're taking away testosterone from binding to the receptor, we're blocking testosterone from binding the receptor, like, why not just get rid of the receptor? Like, if the receptor is the problem, why not get rid of the receptor? And so in every cell, there's a factory to help clean up old proteins. And we call it, like, there's a proteasome, which I call it, like, the garbage disposal in the cell. And there's a cleanup process that happens in the cell to get rid of, like, old proteins as the cell is whatever. And that process sometimes will involve tagging a protein with ubiquitin so that it flags it to say, hey, cell, go put this in the garbage disposal. And so these degraders will basically, some of them that are on the market, will bind the androgen receptor and then tag it for degradation within the proteasome. And we have seen activity. So there's a lot of companies that I think are testing degraders across multiple clinical states in prostate cancer. And we've seen initial really exciting activity predominantly in AR-mutated tumors, so tumors that have a mutation in the androgen. It's not to say that they don't work in non-mutated, but some of the initial efficacy was in that subgroup.
That's really, really fascinating. So let's drill down a little bit more on an issue you were just kind of alluding to, which gets into choice of ADT, mm-hmm. and particularly the potential role of relugolix. One thing I was kind of wondering about is how much information do we have about, you would think that combining relugolix with other things, you have presented a case, abiraterone, you know, whatever, enzalutamide, et cetera, you would think it would be the same, although I guess conceivably there could be drug-drug interactions. What do we know about relugolix in combinations with other endocrine therapies, and do we need to test everything, or can we just assume it's going to be the same as with an agonist?
No, very good question, and I think that's actually why the OPTICS trial was also designed. That's the prospective phase 4 study. You know, obviously there's retrospective data, but in the context of that trial, at least a third or half of the patients were on combination therapy with another AR targeting agent, whether it be Abby, Enza. And so we haven't really seen any significant toxicity. I think in the initial label, there was a call to monitor QTC with Abby, but I don't treat it differently than another GnRH analog that I'm using.
So again, just to continue along this way in terms of thinking through, right from the beginning, the issue was going to be in terms of adherence. I see a lot of papers in your CV looking at it. You mentioned a bunch of studies, and there's even more than some of what you presented. One of the cases you used, I wrote this down here, you used the term self-discontinued, relating to it. That I think it was your first patient who was on and off relugolix for all these years and all. But at this point, what I was kind of surprised, I'm not sure if I understood those graphics right. Were you actually saying that you see more adherence with oral than injectable?
We did see more adherence with oral than injectable. So I think it's not to say a little bit different. So certainly with degarelix, but some of that could also be, so this is why we looked at persistence versus adherence. So persistence is, are you being prescribed the drug? And adherence is, if you're being prescribed, are you taking the drug? And so we did actually demonstrate that in the context of people being prescribed the therapy, they did actually come in and or like fill their scripts and do that kind of more consistently than.
So are you saying that a lot of people sort of skip injections? Or
they may be delayed, or they're like not exactly getting it on their exact, like, you know, 12-week time point or whatever it is, time point. I don't think the intention in the analysis was to say that it's better than Lupron or better. I think the intention was to rather say, no, that in actuality, if patients are prescribed their drugs, they're taking their drugs. And they're, you know, it's not like they're coming in, they're filling their scripts, they're taking their drugs. And so the real world data is skewed because it's basically, we're not actually testing, like, did the patient put the pill in their mouth? We're using claims data. We're using, did the patient go to the pharmacy and actually pick up the medication from the pharmacy? Was a claim filled? And if you're going to the pharmacy, you're picking up the meds, you're paying the copay. We're assuming you're taking it. If you're doing it on schedule, you know, we're assuming you're taking it. So it's a little bit kind of like a surrogate. But in actuality, I think the take-home message isn't that one is better than the other, but rather adherence is high with orals and on par with what it is with injectables in the clinic.
Well, I don't know. Maybe it's like a generational thing or something, but I feel like there are a lot of people out there who have this idea, oh, I know they're getting it because I'm, you know, giving it to them parenterally.
Oh, totally. Yeah.
And if I'm giving them, particularly if I'm giving them an oral med that causes side effects, that maybe they won't take it. But I think it's very interesting and reassuring that your data suggests that, like you said, people are taking. I mean, there have been arguments like, do women with breast cancer take their tamoxifen? But, of course, adjuvant also is different. These people have PSA levels that they're looking at all the time. So I bet I don't find it hard to believe that they are taking their medicine. And then, you know, kind of beyond that is the practicality of it that I'm curious what your thoughts are, because I know you're a very practical mind and patient-oriented person. I have heard people say this, and tell me what you think about this sentiment, some of your colleagues. Well, I love relugolix when I know it's going to be sort of short-term. I'm going to be doing intermittent therapy, or maybe they've got locally advanced or whatever. But if I know they're going to be on it for years, I'd rather have them get something injectable. Agree or disagree?
Yeah, I can appreciate that message. You know, I think, and I think where that stems from is time to T recovery and ensuring that patients don't stay castrate and, you know, then are dealing with lifelong, you know, hypogonadism. And so I definitely agree with that. I definitely employ that practice in my clinic. Like, if I'm doing just 4 or 6 months of hormone therapy with intermediate risk disease, like, yeah, relugolix is great. And honestly, in people who I'm actually worried about the side effects of ADT, you know, I had a gentleman who had a, you know, seizure disorder, and we were really worried about, you know, how the medication was going to impact his various, you know, other drugs that he was on, and just like his ability to talk. Like, yeah, putting an oral where you can stop and kind of get T recovery in a quicker way. Like, absolutely. I agree that in the context of somebody who you're not intending on ever discontinuing therapy, that an injectable may make sense. It may be easier, but honestly, it's patient preference. It's totally patient preference. Like, if some patients are like, I don't want a shot. I don't want to have to come in. Like, do a video visit with me. Like, I don't want to do that. Like, but some patients are like, you know what? I don't want to do another pill. Like, I'd rather do 3 shots a year, 4 shots a year and be done with it. So for me, it just provides a choice, and it should be discussed with patients. It's not like a one size fits all thing, you know?
I mean, you know, we talk all the time about offering patients the opportunity to be involved in treatment decisions. I think that's happening out there. I hope it's happening out there. And certainly, in this situation, I can imagine a patient would be pretty upset if they're just told, oh, we're going to give you this injection, and aren't told. And incidentally, I mean, you're fine to go, there is a pill out there, but here's why I don't think you should take it. But I don't think you're not too happy about just saying, oh, here's the injection. That's what we're going to do.
Yeah.
But another thing I want to ask you about in terms of ADT that really gave me pause, you know, I love the EMBARK study. It's one of my favorite studies in oncology, period, mm-hmm. not just prostate cancer. And one of the things I loved about it the most is that our standard of care, which was ADT, well, yeah, of course it got helped along there by adding something in, and that's no surprise. But The thing that surprised me, given that ADT, for at least for, quote, biochemical relapse, was really the only therapy that was been used for a long, long time, that Enza alone beat it. So, I mean, I know nobody uses ADT alone anymore, but any thoughts about why? Do you agree that you actually saw greater benefit with Enza than you did with ADT? And if so, why do you think that was?
You know, it's hard to say. I will say there was not like a formal comparison between Enza, mono, and Lupron. The study wasn't necessarily designed in that specific way. But I think when you look at the numbers numerically, it almost seemed like Lupron was at the bottom and then Enza and then the combination. I don't know if it's because Enza has these additional properties of beyond just blocking the activity of the androgen receptor, it actually also prevents the androgen receptor from translocating into the nucleus, from binding into androgen response. So there's this other mechanistic things that are happening beyond just blocking. Whereas if you think of Lupron, like there aren't these other things that are happening. You're just taking away T. You're just dropping T levels down. And so could that be why? It's hard to speculate, you know.
Well, anyhow, I mean, initially, again, I thought, you know, you're going to see a huge difference in, you know, sexual function, all these other things. Now that we've had a couple of years to sort it out, I don't really hear a lot of enthusiasm for ENZ alone anyhow. And plus, I don't think people are using LHRH alone anyhow, but just kind of interesting. Another thing about the EMBARK study I thought was so amazing, because as you said, in reality, it turns out that they were actually treating metastatic disease, right?
Yeah,
like,
I mean,
they were almost all... They would have been PSMA positive, like 80% of them. So now that we have, we knew they had metastatic disease anyhow. We just couldn't prove it. But in any event, and again, it's kind of like a little bit terminology. But so to me, in my mind, now I'm starting to get like, how do you think through somebody with metastatic disease where they had local therapy, they're getting followed very carefully with PSA. And then they're getting picked up at a point where they're only PSMA positive, so, you know, no, asymptomatic and minimal. Like, is that the same as somebody comes in de novo, symptomatic, and all that? But putting that aside, because like I said, now it's hard to even figure out what is metastatic disease. But in your talk, you talked about sort of the classic papers from, I guess, 12 or 13 years ago where they looked at intermittent and, PSMA only and METs and... The clinical paradigm came out that I have already always heard, if you're treating PSA-only disease, it's okay to do intermittent. If it's metastatic, it's not.
Yeah.
But now you've got the EMBARK study out there. And, you know, the whole, even I mean, oncologists are hearing constantly about, intermittent therapy of CLL also. It's not just prostate cancer anymore. So it really seems very, and you know, I hear stories that men really do feel better when they come off therapy.
Yeah.
So I guess my question to you is, any sense about whether, you, at least using your parameter for offering, discussing with a patient intermittent therapy, compared to what you think your colleagues in GU oncology investigators are doing, and to general community oncologists, do you feel that intermittent therapy is being used at the level that you use it, less or more?
Yeah. So I think it is being used. I think, but I also want to clarify EMBARK, because I think there's a lot of devils in the details with EMBARK. And I think when we think of intermittent therapy and when I employ intermittent therapy in my practice, it's not just one off period. There's multiple off periods if the patient can handle it. But the way EMBARK was designed, it was a very smartly designed trial. It was a trial that was designed to win. It was a trial that was designed to be a positive trial. So the first thing I'll say is you didn't stop therapy. You didn't go on an off period unless you hit an undetectable PSA point, less than 0.2. And when you resume treatment, when you came... Yeah, we know when you got out of your off period and you resumed on the combination you were assigned lifelong. continuous until you progressed. So in actuality, Embark only tested one off period in patients who had an extreme response. In a cohort of individuals who 40% of them would have had metastatic disease distant mets, the other 40 would have had pelvic disease, and 20 would have actually been truly BCR. So you're kind of like basically doing Enzamet or Arches all over again with one break in between. And so, and in the when patients were on treatment, all of the PSAs were done centrally. Could you, like, we could never do this trial today. Could you imagine us doing a trial like where you could not do a local PSA? You were not allowed. It was centrally checked. And when you hit the trigger point to resume, you were permitted to resume, but you resumed continuously until radiographic progression. So it was a trial that was like basically like an MHSPC trial with one holiday in an extreme responder, which is not how we do intermittent therapy in clinic. It's not how I do intermittent therapy in clinic.
So, for example, if you have a patient, I'm still going to call it endocrine sensitive so I can remember all the letters and all, but endocrine sensitive that's going to be on it for a long time. Like, how many times do you think you cycle through with them stopping therapy?
Yeah, I mean, it's variable. You've got some extreme responders that really do quite well. And then you've got other people that, you know, as soon as their testosterone starts to tick back up, their PSA is climbing back up. And in my experience, with each iterative round, the nadir doesn't get as low and the time off doesn't get as long. And eventually you find a met, you know. So usually it's like, you know, 2 to 3 rounds before then you're leading them on continuous therapy. But the thing about it is now we've got, you know, you find a little met here or there on a PSMA PET scan, you SBRT them.
Right,
and we're kind
right,
of the,
absolutely.
The Wild West out here, you know.
No, I like it. Okay, so I want to just fly through a few other things that are not even related to ADT, but I want to ask you based on your incredible CV. So a couple of quick things. CAR T for prostate cancer. Does it work?
Yes.
Wow, really?
Potentially. I mean, we haven't yet demonstrated that we could do it in a safe manner that results in sustained efficacy. This is not a treatment because of how intense the treatment is. And we just actually published our experience with Poseida with the PSMA CAR T because of the risk that's associated with the treatment. The bar is higher, I think, from an efficacy standpoint, at least for me. Like, this is not a therapy that we're going to go through and give to get like a, you know, 4 to 6 month PFS and that's it. Like, you know what I mean? Like, and then subject an individual to lifelong treatment or lifelong toxicity or even death. And then, not to say to waste their time, like, the fact that they need to be in the hospital with prolonged admissions and all of these things. Like, so we're not quite there yet, though I think the technologies are improving dramatically. I think what's been really exciting for me, at least, is the T cell engagers. I mean,
that's what I was going to ask you. That was my
amazing,
next question.
You know, to see.
So you guys have, do you have that? Like CD3 bispecifics? Really?
Yes. CD3 bispecifics, and so there's
just like
there's now,
tarlatamab in small cell, right? Okay.
Yep, and we actually have a study that's opening up with tarlatamab for neuroendocrine prostate cancer.
That's another story. Yeah.
So, but there's
the
a lot of
them. CAR T. Well, that's cool. That's cool. All right, another area of interest that I keep asking people about, but now I see it in your CV. Which, of course, everywhere in oncology, we hear about MRD, cell-free DNA assays. And I think everybody figured you guys didn't need it because you have PSA. But I see you've got some pubs looking at that. So do you see a role for MRD, cell-free DNA in prostate?
I actually do see a role. And I think, actually, the Capitello data started to unfold a little bit of that. And the reason why I say is because there can be a dissociation between PSA and imaging. And certainly in the MCRPC setting, you can have, you know, changes in PSA that don't actually directly correlate with what's happening radiographically. And what we've been able to demonstrate in the metastatic setting, and we just had a large phase two study with robust analysis on the ctDNA profiling in the study called COMRADE. It was just presented at GU ASCO, that baseline tumor fraction was highly prognostic of PFS and OS. And actually the kinetics, like early kinetics, you know, like a drop or resolution of tumor fraction at cycle two was also prognostic. We did a study with radium olaparib where the PSA response rate was actually quite low because radium doesn't really cause a PSA response rate. And there was not a single patient who had a PSA response at cycle two. But when you look at this tumor ctDNA dynamics, it's a lot more instructive about you know, how a patient may perform. So I do think there's going to be a role, but we're going to have to find that niche of the overplay between imaging and PSA and tumor fraction. Because, you know, in current practice now, even if a patient's PSA is going up, we're not taking them off therapy. You know, we're milking every last ounce of goodness out of a treatment because you don't have like an infinite number of options. And you never want to cut short a therapy that still's got, you got some meat on the bone there still, you know?
You know, it's number three on my list that I was going to ask you off your CV, which is olaparib radium 223 ? Where did that come from? I mean, I like it, but like, what do you know? What do we know about it?
So very interesting. So this was like, this study was designed, gosh, like 14 years ago when radium first came on the market and we were just beginning to understand the DNA repair pathway in prostate cancer. But the strategy was rather, how can we sensitize tumors to radiopharmaceuticals? What are strategies to enhance the activity of a radiopharmaceutical? And radium 223 was actually the first radiopharmaceutical across any disease to demonstrate an improvement in overall survival. And it was, even though I think it's a drug that's not utilized as much today, I think it's helped pave the way for where we are right now with other radiopharmaceutical strategies. But nonetheless, the trial was designed to basically enhance the activity with another DNA damaging agent to see if the radium can induce more tumor kill and have a more dramatic effect. And so the study was conducted in an unselected population because it was conducted in a manner of how do you leverage the DNA single-strand, double-strand breaks that are occurring from radium, predominantly the, you know, it's not a high number of single-strand breaks, but there's certainly single-strand breaks that occur with an alpha particle preventing PARP from being able to repair those single-strand breaks. And so we demonstrated, and I think it's probably the largest study conducted with a DNA damaging agent combined with radium, we demonstrated that you can actually very safely combine the two agents. We did low-dose olaparib at 200 milligrams twice a day instead of 300 milligrams twice a day. We treated 145 patients on the trial, and it was pretty well-tolerated regimen. And the study was positive for improvement in PFS with the combination compared to radium alone.
And now, was this in BRCA patients or every
unselected?
You see better in-
It was unselected because, again, the effect is not – it's basically radium induces single-strand DNA breaks that require PARP for repair. And if you inhibit PARP, you can't repair those breaks. And yes, that we would have suspected that the number of BRCA-mutated patients on the trial was like less than 5 in each arm. This effect was not driven by the – BRCA patients, very low in
That's
number.
That's really interesting. So one final question. ASCO GU practice changing or really spectacular presentations on prostate cancer you want to mention?
Honestly, I think probably the top line data, I guess the PIECE 3 overall survival results were presented. This was a study looking at radium enzalutamide versus enzalutamide for patients with, you know, MCRPC kind of frontline, demonstrating improvement in OS. The rapid oral abstract session, there's a lot of really exciting drugs. You know, we saw data for VR 500, which is a PSMA T-cell engager with very, you know, interesting results. We saw data for the combination of pasritamig, which is a KLK2 T-cell engager combined with docetaxel in the poster session. So I think there's a lot of really exciting compounds that are going to shake up the landscape for prostate cancer. There's so many phase threes right now that are going on in mCRPC.
This concludes our program. Conflict of interest statements for the faculty can be found in the program notes. The use of agents and treatments that are not approved may be discussed, so check out the package inserts for more. Special thanks to Dr. McKay, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Today.